49. The tumult of hooves charging up the mountainside commingles with the grinding crunch of tank treads rolling over the stony clearing beyond the forest's grasp. The steeds charge fearlessly into battle, even when the first gunshots ring out, even when the miniguns unleash laser-focused beams of bullets into their bodies. The horses scream in pain, briefly. I cringe at the sound. I had grown fond of the rides, not because I'm an animal lover in general, but because they were good soldiers. They carried us toward and through danger, facing inhuman fears, and pushing past them like no person ever could, myself included. But like all soldiers, their lives were controlled by people whose agenda require sacrifice. As the last of the horses cries out, its body slapping onto the hard stone surface 100 feet above, I push myself deeper beneath the fallen tree that is my hiding spot. Breathing slowly, face coated with dirt, cloaked in a blanket of thick ferns, I am invisible. Short of being stepped on, I should be impossible to detect. Should be. We know too little about Sulkalu, and what we do know is steeped in Cherokee and biblical stories that might not be true. What I do know is that he is an experienced hunter, a savage killer, and a damn fast healer. I also know he's not immortal, in the sense that he can't be killed, and that he's protective of his head. But are his ears sensitive enough to hear my heartbeat? The gentle ebb and flow of air in my lungs. Can he smell as well as a dog? Can his bare feet sense subtle vibrations in the ground if someone shifts their weight? If the answer to any of those questions is yes, then this will go down as the worst plan of my military and security careers. Then again, it's not my plan. It's Enola's. She set it in motion by sending her horse uphill. As soon as I saw it charge away, I understood and instructed the others to do the same. The heavy-hooved horses left an easy-to-follow trail towards Synergy's awaiting drones, the same trail Sulkalu will have followed all the way up the mountain. Treading lightly, we veered away from the trail on foot, careful to step only where ferns and other unrecognizable ground growth would conceal our footprints. Now we're hunkered down behind a tangle of fallen trees, waiting silently for the giant to pass us by. And we don't have to wait long. I hear Sulkalu before I see him. His oversized lungs huff as he charges up the mountain. At his pace, he'd have caught us near the peak, even if Langdon hadn't tried to stop us. Looking through a curtain of moss hanging from the fallen tree's underside, I see him thunder into view. He's bathed in the blood of whatever creatures he came across in the field below. It's caked dry in some places. Coagulated clumps dangle in his dark red hair, hanging out from under the saber-toothed head covering. He looks more beast than man now, and that's what he is. Despite being intelligent, he is driven by instinct alone and a hatred for mankind, particularly those who have managed to wound and elude him. But he's even more savage than the dinosaurs, driven by vengeance rather than simple survival. He's evil, I think. I've fought and killed the enemies of the United States, and while their political, religious, or general worldview put them violently at odds with my country, I wouldn't describe them as evil. Misguided, deluded, taken advantage of, but not evil. Sulkalu is nothing but, and I can't help but wonder if the story of his demonic genesis might be true. I can't imagine something like him evolving. Rampant killing doesn't serve the survival of any species, including people. The very worst of men are always taken down by the best, memorialized as madmen by history and generations to come. There is no evolutionary benefit to being a psychopath, a serial killer, or a genocidal leader. But that doesn't stop them from existing. And from Sulkalu's perspective, there are no consequences for his actions. We'll see about that, I think, tensing as his pace slows. When he stops, I start plotting a strategic retreat. The only chance some of us have at surviving is if we scatter. How long will it take him to find everyone? How fast can he move? Too many damn questions. He crouches where we stopped before sending the horses to their fate, pressing his fingers into the earth. He lifts his head and sniffs the air. Shit, I think. But then I realize the air is thick with the scent of horse blood flowing on the downhill breeze. I hold still when he does a quick scan of the area. He's suspicious. It's clear the horses stopped, but he doesn't know why. For a moment I think he's going to scour the surrounding area, but one of the horses above, still clinging to life, lets out a death-throw whinny. With a grunt, Sul Kalu launches himself uphill, charging toward the summit, where he believes his prey await. I listen to him go, his breathing now frenzied and rough, his body crashing through brush and branches. Then, for too long, silence. Did the drones already leave? Have they not seen him? Or are they simply attempting to not incite his wrath? The latter wouldn't be a bad idea, but then this is Sul Kalu we're talking about. He probably came out of the womb with a grudge. Was that monster really born to a woman? I see an image of a mother carrying that monster baby to term. Did he tear his way free? Did she survive the ordeal? I shake my head free of dark thoughts and rise from hiding. If Sul Kalu doesn't engage the drones, we might not have long. But then my fears are put at ease when the giant's battle cry rises from above like a volcanic eruption. The cacophonous shriek of metal crashing into stone announces the beginning of his assault. When it's followed by the whirring of miniguns spinning up, I leap from my hiding spot and whisper, "Go, everyone, now!" We trample and hop through the forest, like bunnies on the run, focusing only on speed, not giving a fluffy-tailed ass if we leave a trail or make a lot of noise. We fully intend to be out of Sul Kalu's reach by the time the battle above us is done playing out. And even with excellent hearing, there is no way he can hear us over the buzzing miniguns. Plus, he has bigger problems. He can heal fast, and he seems to revel in pain that would send any other living thing into shock. But miniguns unleash up to 6,000 rounds per minute. That's 100 rounds per second. And I count at least 4 different weapons unleashing metal fury. When people are struck by minigun barrage, they all but cease to exist. The giant is a lot bigger than the average person, but that just means he's a larger target. He's also quick, which is probably why the guns are firing in quick spurts rather than just unloading a stream of bullets into an unmoving body. It's hard to believe anything could survive against that kind of modern might, but the weapons of modern war were designed to work against people, not demigods. "Aim for his head," I think, and I resist the urge to shout it out. As much as I want Sul Kalu cut down, I wouldn't mind if he also managed to diminish Langdon's power in the process. A fleet of flying drones buzzes past overhead. I duck at the sound, watching 2 dozen of the things careen toward the battle. Langdon is throwing everything he has at the giant. He's been watching Sul Kalu long enough to understand the danger the hunter presents. Explosions shake the forest. A deep resonating roar follows, tracing the border between anguish and orgasm. And then, quiet. Levi mumbles, "Buddha, shitty britches." Did they do it? I wonder. Is Sul Kalu? A fresh roar, angry and defiant, rips through the air. It's followed by the shattering of something metal and then more gunfire. Trees behind us explode as an errant stream of bullets tears through the forest. "Down!" I shout, tackling Cassie to the dirt. A line of wood-shredding rounds cuts through the air above us. Some of the small trees shatter and crack before toppling over. Below me, Cassie's eyes go wide. "Look out!" She shoves me off into the side, rolling with me. A tree trunk thumps to the damp ground where we'd been lying. "Thanks," I say, suddenly aware that she's on top of me, her legs wrapped around my waist. Nothing about it is sexual, until we both notice. She smiles down at me. "Right back at you." Then she's on her feet and yanking me up. I spot Owen smiling at me and I shake my head. He hasn't even hit puberty yet. I flinch at the sound of a second fusillade of bullets, but this time they're not randomly spraying the forest. They're unleashing hell, but how long can they keep it up? The drones fired a lot of rounds in the first assault. They're going to run out of ammo eventually. And when they do, will the giant's focus remain on synergy? Or will he come back for us? Knowing the question is without answer, I focus on putting us out of his reach. "Anyone see it?" Shaking heads are the only reply. "Spread out, keep looking." After a minute of searching, I'm afraid we've missed it, or we were wrong about our location, but then I see it. The hatch through which we rescued Enola and confronted Sul Kalu and the saber-toothed cat. The snow is missing, but the hatch is easy to identify, because it's covered in the Elder Kuzneski's remains. It's also closed. Langdon must have sent someone to shut it behind us. "Here," I say, rushing toward the hatch. I drop to my knees beside it, looking for a latch or a locking mechanism. But it's just a smooth metal dome. I dig my fingers into the seam and pull. Two of my nails bend and break from the effort, which ends in my hands snapping up. We're not getting through here without a brick of C4. Flores raps on the hatch with his knuckles. Probably more than that. What now? My father asks. Langdon's distracted, Cassie says. He's throwing everything at the giant. Maybe we can breach the perimeter.
You're forgetting about the spiky death fence, Levi says.
And there's no way he's left himself completely undefended, Flores adds. Do not forget Sul Kalu, Enola says. If he yet lives and we expose ourselves to him. Despite all this, Cassie is still right. We don't have much of a choice. Owen says, but I barely hear him as I look for a fallen tree small enough for us to carry uphill, throw against the fence, and use as a crude siege tower. I flinch when he shouts, "Hey!" All eyes turn down to my younger self, who is standing in a lumpy, drawing mass of what used to be a person. My heart breaks for him. This is too much. But he doesn't seem to notice where he is and what he's standing in. His attention is squarely on the hatch.
Listen!
Despite the distant sounds of continuing battle, a repeating squeak rises up from the hatch. We all take a step back and point our weapons down. When the hatch rises and I see the face staring back at me, I nearly pull the trigger. It's Langdon.